on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And coming up today, a new report on wildfire risk in areas of Tasmania.
Uncontrolled fires, in fact, can burn over frozen land, and that's occurred in Siberia and in Canada. So a lot of people equate uncontrolled fires with high temperatures, but really the key is dry fuel and wind.
And research into a commercial flower crop important for Tasmanian farmers.
So most of my research is on pyrethrum. And I have two main projects at the moment. One is looking at developing a rapid test to monitor pathogens of pyrethrum, and the other is to support BRA to shorten the amount of time it takes to grow their crop.
Yeah, research into pyrethrum coming up. The pretty fields of flowers that often dot the northwest of the state. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Tuesday, where we also look at a new report on whether wildfires like the one seen in America 12 months ago could be seen in parts of Australia, including on the outskirts of Hobart and Launceston. That story coming up for you. Also today, what's causing some waterways in the south of the state to turn red? And it's not an algal bloom that is present in South Australian waters. It's a different one. We'll check the latest on the weather just after 12:35, lunchtime in the cricket. And you can stay in touch via that text line 0438 922 936 is the number. First up today, an Angus beef exporter from the New South Wales Hunter Valley believes China's 55% tariff will have a detrimental effect on his industry. Robert McKenzie is concerned for smaller producers like himself and is calling for a quota system to manage the 205,000-tonne quota. He exports a container load with 26 tonnes of premium cuts to China a month, with a shipment due to leave this week. He's speaking here to Kim Honan.
We're only sending a container every month, so they're only a small percentage of our monthly production, but they're still a very important part of our supply chain. Very important. We send a certain amount of cuts there that just help us navigate where all of that production of that animal goes, and they take some cuts that aren't as sought after in other markets. So they're definitely an important part of our program.
So what sort of cuts do you send?
Oh, look, we'll send shin shank and tri-tips and just certain cuts that aren't as popular in other markets.
And so what sort of impact do you think this tariff will have on your business?
I think it'll have a big impact on Australian agriculture. I'm worried that a lot of the big processors will flood the market into China with trims, offals and bones, which that will go towards making up that 205,000 metric tonne. That quota could be filled come June, July 2026. And if we're moving regular product into our customers in China come, you know, June or July this year, they're not going to be able to absorb that tariff. So we'll then have to reallocate that product into some other markets. Naturally, when we reach out to those other potential customers, they'll know that the tariff has taken effect on Australian product. And, you know, they'll play a little bit hardball. So we've really got to look at it now. You know, do we look for those other markets beforehand? Or do we wait till the tariff comes into play mid-year? What do we do?
And so if the quota's filled with the cheaper trim, lower-end products, then the Chinese consumer misses out on the Australian premium product. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, as soon as that quota's filled, and whether it's trim, bones, offals or high-end product, whenever that's filled, the consumer's going to miss out on that product. We have to then work out where that product's going to go in other parts of the world. And Australian beef is definitely high up on the menu right around the world. So potentially it might not be hard to move that, but it definitely will come at a cost. There's no doubt about it.
As an exporter, would you try and pass that 55% tariff on to the Chinese consumer? Would they pay that? Is that a consideration?
No, they wouldn't pay it. The Chinese market's very price sensitive now. and they wouldn't be able to absorb that. So there'll be no way that you'd be selling any product into China once that tariff comes into play. So it'll be a little bit of a mess. My thoughts are whether the government and our peak bodies, MLA, Cattle Australia, etc., get together and whether we look at maybe a quota system. So if you're selling product into China in 2024 and it was X amount of kilos or tonnages, you might be allowed to have that quota for 2026, and then it won't be such a rush to the door. It's just going to be a rush for people to pump that product into China. It'll just go into cold stores, be frozen, and they'll just use it throughout the year. But it's just going to really make us or smaller producers like ourselves manage that supply chain. And also that void when they say, look, we can't take any more. So it's a big decision that we have to make. We're not a big player. We're only a small player, but that market's very important to us.
So if you do keep exporting to China until June when the quota's filled, where do you think you may export to then? What other markets would you might consider?
Well, look, we're sending product into Hong Kong. So it might be Korea. It might be Vietnam. Obviously, it'll be probably for those cuts. It'll be into that Asian market most likely. But then we also got the problem too is, Brazil and Argentina and all that. When they hit their quota, they'll be looking to flood the market also. Anyway, we'll just have to wait and see. But it is a little bit concerning. It concerns me on how we're going to manage it, how the industry will manage it. And we've worked really hard to build solid supply chains in China, working with some really, really good people. And they would be scrambling also, thinking, well, how are they going to manage come the back end of 2026 also?
Robert McKenzie, Director of Macca's Australian Black Angus Stud Beef at Saltash, speaking to Kim Honan about the beef exports to China and the prospect of a 55% tariff once a certain quota is reached.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Trust you're enjoying your Tuesday. Now another story from last year involving a brand new shearing shed. Tasmania's newest shearing shed with a world first inclusion has passed its first ever test by shearers with a big tick of approval. A three-stand shed has been built on a property at Mount Seymour just outside Oatlands and is owned by fifth generation farmer Michael Isles. I caught up with a very happy Michael just after the shearers had finished shearing rams on the property.
Absolutely. First time it's been used, shearing the rams, and way above my expectations.
Fantastic. And we also have another guest from the mainland.
G'day, Tony. Simon Flynn. Flynn Design. We design, manufacture and construct shearing sheds and stockyards all over Australia. Michael's particular shed is the first shearing shed in the world with the ram to instinct, which is the automated catching pens that reduce in size.
Yeah, so tell us, how does that work?
We have a manual version, which has been out for a number of years, and in the Ram 2 Instinct, we have a PLC computer that runs the solenoids and touch screen, tell it how often, how long for, whether you're crutching or shearing, the delay. The Ram 2 basically has a rear gate on the catching pen, which moves at timed intervals, and the timed intervals are it's a nice simple touchscreen, and if you're crutching, it's running faster. If you're shearing, it's running slower.
Michael, you had a couple of shearers here this morning. How did they react to the new shearing shed?
They did not have one complaint. They said that everything worked so well. And the fact that they weren't having to fight the rams to get them out of pens, they were just in the right place for them to get them. The drag was not too far, and they were absolutely thrilled with the way it worked.
What made you look at this design?
The original old shearing shed, we subdivided the historic precinct off the property, and that was part of that. So I needed to build a new shed so that it was a, you know, standalone. So yes, I went through the process of looking at the various sheds available, spoke to Simon. Simon came down and yeah, very impressed with the way they operated. So I went with Flynn Designs.
To ask the question, Simon, how much would a shed like this be?
Most shearing sheds these days are around anywhere between $40,000 to $50,000 per stand. The cost of the shed, the portal frame sheds, have actually gone up more than the internal fit outs in the last sort of 5 to 10 years. The main thing for people to remember is shearing shed maintenance. If your old shed is starting to look a bit tired, every year chip away at it, baby steps, just spend a couple of days every year maintaining it rather than getting to a point where you need to replace it. So we do a lot of shearing shed maintenance. We do a lot of renovations to existing shearing sheds. Now, if you are going to build a brand new shed, it's all about the design. Per square metre, the main manufacturers in the industry, we're all very similar costed. So look at the design, take it seriously. And there's lots of simple design considerations.
You pointed out to me before, it's the little things that matter.
Oh, 100%. It's your grading direction to get the sheep to draw naturally. It's slide bolts in gates, not chains. Chains delay your ability to open the gate, and the lead sheep can't draw through naturally. It's having a flat section when you tip the sheep over in your slope catching pen, so you reduce your muscle strain on the shearers. It's about the hook placement, so your towel's in the right spot and your counter's at a nice level. It's all about fatigue on the shearers and the staff. We've noticed lately a lot of boards are being built like an enlarged edge, so you're becoming issues with hitting fires. We're getting feedback to have a nice raised board, lots of access for your toes, and the rouseabouts have good access to the shearer.
Do you think the shearers thought it was easier and quicker today?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they were constantly saying, compared to the old shed, this is so different. You know, the sheep appeared to flow better. The sheep were calmer when they were pulling them out. There was no... Normally, the ram shearing tends to be a little bit of a rodeo where sometimes the shearer wins and sometimes the ram wins. But today, everything was just calm. The shearers did more than they anticipated in the run. So the productivity definitely went up. The safety aspect is also important. You know, you've got to keep all the employees in the shed as safe as you can and make everything as easy as possible. And yeah, first time it worked like that, like a charm.
So you're feeling pretty good about the investment you've made, which I'm assuming is a pretty big investment.
Yes, very happy. Yes, you assume correctly, but very, very happy with the outcome, very happy.
And what are you finding, Simon, about the extra numbers of sheep that can go through sheds like this?
A well-designed modern shed, they theoretically should be shearing anywhere between 10 and 20% more if it's designed well. We're finding in our sheds, and I'll just make note, offset chutes are a must in a brand new shed. If you're not restricted by existing frames, etc., when you're renovating, if you're building a brand new shed, offset chutes are a must because you increase your efficiency up to 30%. 20% is pretty common in any of our brand new sheds. You combine that with the ram TU, where you've got your reduced catching pen sizes, so you're nudging up a little bit higher. The main two considerations we find of new sheds is firstly animal instinct. They crave it, they're drawn by it, animals can't ignore it, so use it. And then the second challenge is when you're building a brand new shed, you can't just use new materials and rebuild an outdated design. It's absolute garbage. And it's we have to build new design, updated sheds. Well, it's going to last 60, 80, 100 years.
What sort of reaction in Tasmania have you got to your product? Have you got many other sheds?
Yeah, we've got another one up on the North Coast. We've been asked to come over here about 3 or 4 years ago by some shearers. We started a bit of a following from shearers that had been on the mainland and seen what we did and how we did it. We take it very serious from a design aspect. And yeah, we've been here 3 or 4 years. We've got several projects completed now, and we've got several more in the pipeline. So
The traditional shearing sheds, even modern ones, what's wrong with them?
Look, I would just, if you're talking about an older shed, as I said, just plug your Uzi leaks first. Fix the grating. Use screws, not nails, guys. Screws have been around for 3,000 years. You talk about innovation. Innovation is about adopting new ideas. So if you've been using nails and your grating's moved and pulled up and buggered, get the screw that was invented 3,000 years ago because it's just going to do a better job. Fix up your catching pen doors. Use three hinges, not two, because two will sag over time. Fix up all the simple things. Do it methodically and make real change. Hot water and toilets. I go 40 interviews 2 years ago when we won an award at a field day, and that was my main comment. Toilets. Put toilets and hot water on, guys. It's a really big change you can make to everyone's world. It might seem simple, but if your wife or daughter wouldn't use the current toilet at your shearing shed, it's not bloody good enough.
And Michael, you must get some pressure from shearers to say, listen, we need better facilities, we need better conditions.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about that. And some of the old sheds, and my old shed was atrocious as far as conditions. Yeah, the facility side of things needed to be fixed up. You know, we've got the hot water here. There will eventually be a shower block, but at this stage it was a little bit of red tape to get that all pushed through in time for the build. But, you know, we have a port-a-loo toilet system. We have hot water inside and out. So, yeah, it's a lot better for the shearers.
And where does the power come from at the moment?
At the moment, the power is through a generator. Again, red tape with Aurora and prohibitive costs to get power to the shed meant that the generator was by far the most economical way of going.
Will that stay, the generator?
Yes, that will stay. Okay. And I won't have any... No power blackouts, so shearing won't be stopped because the power's gone off.
Have you looked at things like solar for the roof?
No, I haven't looked at solar for the roof at this stage, Tony, no. But, not ruling anything in or out, what could happen.
Midlands farmer Michael Isles talking about his new shearing shed on the Mount Seymour property after a couple of shearers tested the shed for the first time on a number of rams very successfully. And we also heard from shed designer Simon Flynn on the Country Hour.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, a cherry grower in Victoria's northeast says he's harvesting one of his best cherry crops this year, but many of them are likely to rot on the tree because the cherries are late and less demand for cherries after Christmas. But for Fete Chambrion from Europa Gully Orchards near Stanley, east of Wangaratta, cherries is just one crop he grows on the farm.
I'm probably the third generation that owns this property, the Chambrion Farm. My grandfather was a miner and my father was an orchardist. I took the orchard over when I was 16, I'm now 78. But in the meantime, I had other employment. So we're probably the longest continuous farmers in the area. Now we're growing cherries, apples and chestnuts. Sorry about that noise. Our gas gun going off to scare the birds. They're our enemy. This year our cherry crop is just abundant because ideal conditions during pollination time, we had fine weather and the weather's been kind to us as far as rains, no cracking. But unfortunately, because we haven't had the hot weather, our cherries didn't ripen up and our main sales are before Christmas. But unfortunately, we only had 2 days of sales before Christmas. Now we have tons of cherries here that we are a bit concerned about. Similar thing happened 2 years ago. Same problem. We left 10 tonnes of cherries on the tree to rot.
Wow, 10 tonne.
10 tonne we estimated. And probably we're looking at 5 or 6 tonne this year that will rot on the trees because we rely on Picyon. Mm. We don't supply the supermarkets. The simple reason we don't supply the supermarkets, we're not set up for grading. Supermarkets insist on cherries being a bit bigger, which we don't put a chemical on to make them bigger, and the cherries in the supermarket are dipped in chlorine to make them look fresh. The first thing that deteriorates on a cherry is the stem will dry, so they're actually dipped in chlorine to make the stem look green. So ours are fresh, no pesticides on our cherries, but we do use fungicides.
So, like you're saying there, a bit about the season this year, it's been quite cold and quite late to heat up and really get the sugars and the colours going in the cherry. So it wasn't really until a few days before Christmas. What happens after Christmas? Does the demand for cherries just drop off? Well,
I've always said once New Year's Day comes, no one wants cherries. Really? It's a Christmas thing. It's a tourist thing. And after New Year's Day, we just will not get people here. You know, our prices are down as low as you can possibly get. They're $8 a kilo. We don't charge entry fees, so people can come in and enjoy themselves and eat and buy the cherries, fresh picked cherries.
And we're looking out at your cherry trees at the moment. You can see all the little red cherries just sort of glistening in the sun. Yeah, you can just see how many are here.
It's a big crop. It's a huge crop. Probably a bit smaller than we would like them to be, but I think that's just because of the massive crop. Our fertilising program didn't take place during the year for other reasons. So it's just a big crop. And normal year we'd have a certain amount of drop. This year we didn't. The pollination was just absolutely perfect for because the bees were able to work when we're out in blossom. So it's just a massive set. And none of them dropped because they're ideal conditions, except towards the finish, December, we never had that heat to ripen them up and finish them up. The sugar content is perfect in them. They're really sweet, even though some haven't got a lot of colour. The sugar content is fantastic.
Peter, what else do you grow out here? Looking around, you've also got some apple trees. You've got Christmas trees, does it look like?
Yeah, we had a good year with our Christmas trees. We grow a different variety of Christmas trees. The ones you buy in the shop are, we call radiatas. Ours are the Douglas firs or Oregons, whatever you like to call. So people, that's been successful and that's got us through to Christmas. So we sell those for $50, doesn't matter what size they are, just $50. I couldn't be bothered measuring them. And then later on we'll open up for pick your own apples. Over the years we've been $2.50. Then we have our own pick your own chestnuts. And last year we put sunflowers in and that was very successful, which we've also done this year for people to come and pick their own flowers. So we sort of haven't got all our eggs in the one basket. If we fail on the cherries, we hope to pick up on something else. So it's about 3,000 fruit trees here to look after.
So an eclectic mix, really, you've got going on. It's different crops, yeah.
Different crops, yeah. We grow a few plums, which we'll just do the markets with those, the farmers market in Wodonga. Later on, it's a big crop of those. So, as I said, it's been ideal for pollination this year. Everything was going right for us. And we haven't had to use many fungicides. We just haven't had that humid weather. So it's all good.
I want to talk to you about growing fruit in Stanley. So Europa Gully Orchard, you come down Dirt Road onto Shamron Road, so your family's...
we called Europa Gully Orchard because this is a mining area and the little valley we're in here was called Europa Gully. Like in the gold mining days, they named different areas like Milkman's Flat, Poverty Gully, all the... So we named it Europa Gully because... My grandfather was a miner and he died of miner's disease, which we would call emphysema now. Yeah. And on his death certificate said Alphonse Chambéron of Europa Gully. So that's why we have called the property Europa Gully, just to keep that little bit of history.
That's Peter Chambéron from Europa Gully Orchard speaking to Annie Brown about his diverse farm operation. Well, Stanley in Victoria's northeast is a traditional apple-growing region, but there are some new kids on the block who are using regenerative techniques. Jade Miles and Charlie Showers operate Black Barn Farm, where they grow apples and berries.
Well, I'm Charlie Showers, and with Jade Miles and our kids, we run Black Barn Farm in Stanley. Black Barn Farm is an organic and regenerative horticultural operation. So we do pick your own berries, currants, apples and pears, amongst a range of other things. We do we sell trees and berries in pots and also bare rooted over winter. We run a range of different workshops. We do flowers as well, which is new this year. We have an education component too, so we do a lot of school groups. And adult education around homesteading and farming.
Oh, a big range of things happening here at Black Barn Farm. Jade and Charlie, I was just saying to you, Jade, it was about 4 or 5 years ago I last came out here and the barn wasn't here, and now we're in this big, beautiful barn at the moment. It's great to see it's
Yeah, it's come to fruition. Yeah, we milled the timber off the property for this barn, and we always knew that the barn would be the central piece and it would be where we would run the workshops and it would be where we would gather our community, really. And so they're coming from all over, and they're not just Stanley and Beechworth, but people come from all over for our workshops. Sometimes they're multi-day workshops or schools programs. They might come for a multiple day camp. And so it really gives us the opportunity to year-round gather people, talk about the importance of understanding the landscape that we're sitting in and how it's holding us from an ecological perspective. And that really then plays out in the way we make all our farming decisions as well. So we do everything we can to grow as close to nature as we possibly can. So we don't add synthetic anythings, which means that the food that we're eating can be picked straight from the vine or straight from the cane or straight from the tree. And it really gives us an opportunity to talk to people. It looks a bit wild too, you'll notice. It doesn't look quite as manicured and immaculate as lots of people imagine orchards could and should look. Mm-hmm. And that's completely intentional. That allows us to enhance the range of biodiversity that's out there and life, essentially. So we feel like we've created a landscape that is filled to the brim with life. And sometimes that feels at odds with people's expectations, but once you explain to them that it's all done intentionally because it's actually the healthiest way an ecosystem can operate, it feels... or people settle with it. They feel much better about it. And it could be that they're also eating an apple cider donut at the same time and so they feel a bit better about it.
Yeah, we'll get to the donuts. This has got to be one of the best-smelling farms, I said to you when I got out of the car. It's just a donut coming through. Charlie, tell us a bit about what's growing in the orchards at the moment. What's the season been like?
Slow. So, yeah, it's been a slow season. We had a very, very cold spring and early summer. We had our last frost on the 27th of December, and we've never had a frost that late before. And particularly in November was really cold, which the berries don't necessarily dislike. It just delays the season. So we're running probably 2 weeks behind where we normally would be. So there's lots of berries. They're just taking a little bit longer to ripen this year. But we're getting a lot of good heat at the moment, so things are definitely coming along. So at the moment we've got raspberries and currants ripe. We've got all of our brambleberries, so Sylvan and Marion, and all the thornless blackberries coming on as well. So we'll be in full production and full ripeness in the next few days as we get a good amount of
and
heat.
Apples are only a week or two away. Maybe three or four.
Yeah, the bulk of our apples really don't come in until the middle of February. Our early season apples, which we mostly use for processing here on farm, come in January, but the ones that the public start picking usually happens about mid-February.
A bit optimistic, Jay.
Well, I keep forgetting about the delay as well. I keep feeling like we're there. And they look pretty good out there, but Charlie's right. The ones that we pick first are the Lloydies and Vistabellas and Gravenstein's, and they tend to be the ones that we dehydrate or stew.
The other really special thing about your farm is the amount of different apple varieties that you grow here. What are you up to at the moment?
We've got about 70 to 80 different varieties of apples. A huge variety, which for us is really important because it allows us to span the season. As Jade said, we've got some very early season varieties that ripen in January, right through to some very late season varieties that you could still be picking in June, and you can't do that with the conventional modern apples. So we have all of the Pink Ladies and Fuji and Gala, but in amongst that we've got some other amazing heritage varieties from countries all over the globe, which are just incredible, and they offer such a different diversity of flavour and eating experience than just your boring supermarket apple. And I say to people, if you've only eaten an apple from the supermarket, then get up to Stanley and grab a fresh apple because it's a completely different eating experience. Like, they are truly, truly different. And apples are always seen as a pretty bland kind of commodity crop because they're always available in the supermarket. Whereas we're trying to introduce that sort of romanticism and intrigue back into apples because there is such a massive variation in taste. Like, we have some that taste like a banana. We have one variety called winter banana that truly has the aftertaste of a lolly banana.
A lolly banana. Gosh. Jade Miles and Charlie Showers from Black Barn Farm. And they were speaking there to Annie Brown about their different types of apples, around about 80 different species of apples on their farm.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Yes, it is lunchtime in the crickets, and it is the Country Hour on this Tuesday. G'day, Tony, with you. Coming up, we'll talk wildfires and also research into pyrethrum. We'll check the weather in just a moment. First up, the news headlines with Loretta Loberger.
Good afternoon, Tony. Former Tasmania Fire Service Chief Officer Mike Brown says the increasing number of people living near bushland is elevating Australia's risk of a devastating fire. Mr. Brown says 6.9 million Australians live on the outskirts of cities, which he says are the zones most exposed to deadly fires. Mr. Brown is a member of the Emergency Leaders for Climate Action, which together with the Climate Council produced a report on Australia's bushfire risk. Tasmania's Environment Department says there's no known link between salmon farming and a phenomena that causes red tides and bioluminescence in the state's coastal waters. Over the past week, southern and eastern beaches have experienced red tides during the day, transforming into sparkling bioluminescence at night. Donald Trump has reportedly said that he'll be the top man in charge of Venezuela. He was speaking to NBC after deposed leader Nicolas Maduro pleaded not guilty to drug charges in a New York court. Mr. Maduro's close ally, Delcy Rodriguez, has meanwhile been sworn in as the country's interim president. And experts are warning that an attack by the US on Greenland would mean the end of the NATO military alliance. President Trump has repeatedly said he wants to take over the Danish self-governed territory, which is rich in minerals.
Thank you, Loretta. Now let's check the latest on the weather. Ursula Connor joins us from the Bureau. Hello, Ursula.
G'day, Tony.
How are you going on this Tuesday?
Oh, very well, thank you. Enjoying the sunshine.
Yes, yes. Is there any rainfall of any note about?
We only had a few millimetres pick up in the gauges sort of before 9 a.m. In the 24 hours prior to that through mainly the southwest. So we did see 6 millimetres pick up at Margaret Lake Dam, 4 millimetres at Strawn Airport, and a bit further south too, we saw a couple of millimetres around sort of Scott's Peak in that area as well. But since 9 a.m, we haven't seen too much pick up in the gauges at all, Tony. It's been quite a fine day out there.
Okay. So what sort of temperatures have we got at the moment?
At the moment, it's 23 degrees in Hobart, 25 in Launceston, 20 in Devonport, 18 in Strawn and 28 in St Helens.
And what's the outlook for the next few days?
Yeah, well, as we move into sort of this afternoon and this evening, we will see a little trough cross sort of the southwest of the state. So a few light showers picking up around there, but elsewhere across the state, we'll see the sunny conditions remaining, just a little bit of high cloud passing over at times. As we move into tomorrow, we will start to see some northwesterly winds increasing a little bit, and that's going to bring down a little bit more heat from the mainland. So we'll see temperatures warming up right across the state tomorrow. That is ahead of a trough which is going to cross Tassie overnight, sort of tomorrow night and into Thursday morning. So that will bring a few showers across the state. They'll be quite light and isolated in nature, but maybe lingering around on Thursday morning before sort of the afternoon clears up. That trough will take away some of the heat from the south of the state, but we will see those temperatures remaining quite warm through the northern, eastern and central parts of the state. As we move into Friday, we're going to see showers developing across the state through the day, potentially even some afternoon thunderstorms about the north. And then on Saturday, a bit of a windy cold front coming through to flush out the heat. We'll see that bring a few showers through the western and southern parts of the state, especially, Tony.
Any warnings?
At the moment, we just have our severe heatwave warning. That one has been issued for the northern, central and eastern districts.
And the coastal waters and swell?
Yeah, if you're heading out on the water today, through the east coast at the moment, we've got just an onshore easterly sea breeze around 10 knots. But elsewhere, we're looking at those western northwesterly winds around 15 to 25 knots. As we move into the evening, we'll see those ease back to around 10 to 15 knots, and that will continue through the day into tomorrow as well. We will see them reaching sort of 25 knots about the northeast during the afternoon. By tomorrow, sort of middle part of the day and afternoon, we'll see those winds dropping out to be quite light and variable through most parts except for that northeast with just some inshore afternoon sea breezes. In the swells through the west and south today, we're looking at a west to southwesterly of 1 to 2 metres, picking up to around 2 to 2.5 tomorrow. Through the north, a westerly around 0.5 metre, and in the east, a southerly around 1 metre.
And the wave riders to wrap it up.
Yes, Cape Sorrel we've currently got sitting at a southwesterly with a significant wave height of 1.8, maximum wave height of 2.7, and Maria Island holding that southerly with a significant wave height of 0.8 metres and a maximum of 1.3.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ursula.
Cheers, Tony.
Ursula Connor from the Bureau with the latest information for you.
On air, online, on digital and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Yeah, lunchtime in the cricket. Well, it's been a year since the devastating wildfires of Los Angeles, which wiped out whole suburbs and killed 30 people. A new report by former fire chiefs and the Climate Council warns that urban areas in Australia are at an increasing risk from bushfires, and an LA-style fire could easily happen in Australia. Greg Mullins is the former New South Wales fire chief and co-founder of Emergency Leaders for Climate Action. He's also a co-author of the report.
So we have a large proportion of legacy building stock, so homes that have been built in urban bushland interface areas on the outskirts of our major cities that were built before the modern bushfire standards, so before 2010. And as we saw in Los Angeles, they're the homes that burn first. But then we get, with the wild weather and wind conditions that they had in Los Angeles and which we've experienced here in Australia, in Canberra in 2003, Black Saturday, Victoria 2009, and of course our Black Summer 2019-20, fires spread from house to house. So you just need a few houses that aren't built to standard that catch a light because of ember attack or flame from the bush directly impacting them. Then they set the three adjoining houses alight, the one at the rear, the one on the on each side, and then those three set 9 alight, those 9 set 27 alight, and then you have a full-blown urban conflagration. It's no longer a bushfire. We've experienced this in places like Hobart in 1967, Ash Wednesday 1983, and I talked about Canberra, Black Saturday and Black Summer. So we know that if we have a major wind event after drought, it doesn't even have to be hot, as we saw in Los Angeles, we could have massive losses. And this is because climate change has supercharged fire weather worldwide.
It's Greg Mullins, former New South Wales Fire Chief and co-founder of Emergency Leaders for Climate Action, and he's also a co-author of the report into the wildfires. Well, Professor David Bowman, Professor of Pyrogeography and Fire Science at the University of Tasmania, has also looked at whether Australia could experience the same sort of fire events in semi-urban areas.
The question that's on our mind is how much have we been just lucky, and how much is it that there are fundamental differences between the United States and Australia, such as the types of buildings, the sorts of fire weather, particularly in LA, that was a wind-driven fire, the very particular sort of wind that was blowing down the side of a mountain. We don't have such extreme wind events as in California, but we have had some extremely bad wind events. Recently, here in Tasmania, 19 houses were destroyed at Dolphin Sands from a wind-driven event. So I wouldn't be ruling out the possibility, but we're just not certain exactly the likelihood that we're exposed.
Yeah, speaking of, I guess, Dolphin Sands, I mean, I think one of the things that people were surprised about with the LA fires was that it was the middle of winter, right? But I guess Dolphin Sands as well was one that proved to us that it doesn't need to be particularly hot, does it, for these big fires?
That's correct. In fact, what was strange about the Dolphin Sands fire was that in October there was also an uncontrolled wind-driven fire here in southeastern Tasmania. And that was outside summer. It was in the spring. It was a very cool spring. And it just shows that you don't need high temperatures to have uncontrolled fires. Very strong winds can set up fires. And once they get going, they sort of like a giant hairdryer. They can start drying the fuel out in front of them. So wind-driven fires, as you've said, there have been fire disasters in the middle of winter in the Northern Hemisphere. You can have uncontrolled fires, in fact, can burn over frozen land, and that's occurred in Siberia and in Canada. So a lot of people equate uncontrolled fires with high temperatures, but really the key is dry fuel and wind. And then, of course, the other factor that comes into this is that once you get these ignitions, fires can actually start generating their own wind.
There are obviously so many factors at play here and addresses a lot of them, but it talked about climate pollutants being a massive problem. It also pointed to the fact that in terms of lightning fires, that the huge increase in fires started by lightning in the past few decades. Is it something you've been noticing, that the fire conditions are getting worse?
No, that's absolutely correct. There's been numerous studies now that are showing that the effect of global warming, high temperatures, is one of the features of this, is that we're seeing worldwide dry fuels. And fuel dryness is really, as I said before, one of the keys to uncontrolled bushfires. We're also seeing a thing called sort of hydroclimatic whiplash, where we're oscillating between very wet conditions, flooding conditions, and suddenly it'll flip back to very dry conditions. We've already seen this occur in the fires of 2019-20, New South Wales, and then there's been incredible rains, incredible flooding, and then it's switching back to being dry. And so we're getting these flip-flopping conditions. And what I like to stress is climate instability. The climate is very, very unstable. And it's like we're being dealt really surprising cards all the time now. It's very difficult to forecast what a fire season is going to do. We have wind-driven fires, and then the winds will go away. Then you might get a heat wave, and then you might get flooding rain, and the last thing on your mind is fire, and then a huge drought comes back. So we're getting this incredible, very dynamic, unstable climate. And that goes with the fact that because of climate change, the climate system is becoming unstable. And one of the consequences of that means it's harder to forecast and predict. And that means that everybody who is living in a flammable environment, and many Australians are, have to have very high levels of situational awareness, because situations can escalate very quickly. In weeks, you can go from a low-risk situation to an extraordinarily high risk. You can have a moderate day, and then the next day you're being confronted by very, very dangerous fire weather. Or you might be in a situation where there's already forecast heat wave, and you might suddenly find that there will be a fire burning, and you're going to have to react to that, and you're down to hours, if not, minutes. to make sensible decisions.
Professor David Bowman from the University of Tasmania speaking to Lucy McDonald about wildfires. And you can see more of that story online at ABC News. Well, in recent days, you may have heard reports about a red algal bloom in waters off Tasmania's south or even seen it for yourself. It sparked environmental concerns from some, but University of Tasmania science professor Gustav Hallegraaff says he's confident it's a common bioluminescent algae known as Noctilla scintillans and isn't the same thing as the devastating algal bloom experienced in South Australia. Reporter Adam Holmes spoke to the professor to find out more.
I've been studying this organism at that location for about 30 years. And yeah, there's no other organism that produces those pink slicks and at the same time is bioluminescent at night. So this is Noctiluca scintillans.
And do you have to explain what that actually is?
So it is a small microscopic organism. It belongs to a group of the dinoflagellates. And this one is quite unusual in that it really behaves much more like an animal than a plant. So for it to grow well, it needs to feed on other organisms, a particular microscopic algae called diatoms. So, and that really drives the bloom. And so these diatoms usually are stimulated by nutrient enrichments, very commonly nutrients coming from offshore. And one nutrient in particular that's important for diatoms is nitrate. So that is a nutrient that not necessarily comes from salmon farms. Salmon release other nutrients like ammonia and urea, and this organism has no need for it. In about the early 1990s into the 2000s, we started to see a strengthening of the East Australian current. That is that warm current that goes from the Coral Sea past Sydney and brings, particularly in this time of the year, warm waters along the east coast of Tasmania. And with it, we have seen this bloom move into Tasmania more and more frequently, particularly about 1990. And then, very interestingly, this current has become more frequent, so that has a climate component to it. And over time, this species has established itself in Tasmania. And we also have blooms now in Tasmania in the middle of the winter. We see blooms, and we've seen Noctiluca blooms along the whole east coast of Tasmania, from Flinders Island to the Tasman Peninsula, all since about the early November, December. And again, they're all areas with no salmon farms. And so it's basically moved now into the Dantrocaster Channel. And to me, the message really is this is not an organism to be feared. We know it very well. It is an organism to be enjoyed, particularly at night, the bioluminescent spectacles. But another thing that the public don't understand very often, when we see the slicks inshore, it is actually a dying phase of the organism. The organism is running out of food and then floats to the surface. And if the wind comes onshore and also it's calm weather like we have now, it floats inshore. And it breaks down very, very quickly in a period of a day. There's nothing left. It's not like a lot of seaweeds that end up rotting on the beach and then stinking. This disappears just like that.
So if the Noctiluca scintillans is in a thriving stage where it has access to a lot of nutrients, does that mean we might not necessarily be seeing it at that point?
This bloom has been developing for sometimes, probably weeks, if not months, gradually at depths, sometimes offshore, feeding on diatoms. And now it's dying because it's running out of food. So it's food that comes from past nutrients from somewhere else. Now it's dying and it's washing inshore, you know, in an area that people think that the fish farms have caused it. But another thing that really disturbed me about a lot of media statements is that some people think this is a sign of, you know, an ecosystem that's in a stressed or unhealthy marine environment. It is actually the opposite. You know, the water environment is way more dynamic than on the land. So there's been a nutrient input very quickly. This Noctiluca capitalized on it. And then probably in a couple of days, it disappears again. If it would be a stressed ecosystem, then you would have a green slime in a swamp that lasts for months and months and months. That would be an unhealthy ecosystem. And for example, that is what we ended up in South Australia, which was a very distressing phenomena where we had a bloom of a very different species, different environmental drivers, which lasted for 9 months and actually killed a lot of fish, sharks, dolphins, killed seaweeds. That is an ecosystem under stress, not Noctiluca.
That was Professor Gustav Hallegraeff from UTAS, ending that report from Adam Holmes on what's causing the bloom in waters in the south of the state at the moment. And you can see photos of the bioluminescent spectacle at ABC Rural Online.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, if you've driven around the north and northwest of the state during pyrethrum flowering time, you would have spotted the beautiful paddocks full of daisy-like white flowers called pyrethrum. They look stunning when in bloom, but they're very susceptible to disease and farmers have to spray them with a lot of chemicals. But not all of those are necessary. Dr. Tamika Pierce from the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture has been working on rapid testing for paddocks to help growers determine what diseases they actually need to treat for the pyrethrum.
So most of my research is on pyrethrum, and I have two main projects at the moment. One is looking at developing a rapid test to monitor pathogens of pyrethrum, and the other is to support BRA to shorten the amount of time it takes to grow their crop.
Now, that rapid testing, is that like a COVID rapid testing? That's what most people imagine probably when they hear
yeah,
that.
Yeah, look, originally we did think of doing a concept like that. But after we spoke to industry at the initial stages of the project, we realised that that wasn't really the approach that they needed to support them. They needed a test that would allow them to actually quantify the amount of pathogen in large-scale tests.
In layman's terms, can you explain what you've come up with so far?
So at the moment, we're trying to come up with a strategy where we can sample leaves in a paddock, take them back to our lab, extract the DNA from those, and in that we extract DNA from both the plant and any pathogens that are present. And we then run a simple test that detects if the pathogen DNA is present or not. And that test will actually tell us how much of the pathogen DNA is present. And that gives us an indication of how much disease is in the paddock. And we can then use that to determine how we might manage that disease.
And do you go out and you have to handpick all of those leaves?
Yep, we do. We have to handpick all those leaves. And we realised this year that the pyrethrum crops get quite large coming into spring and they're quite tricky, particularly when you have short legs like me, to get through. So we're starting to revise our strategy to think about how can we sample paddocks without having to go into them completely. So can we utilise the tram lines that the tractor has for irrigation spraying, for example, so that we don't have to destroy the crop in our sampling.
That makes sense. And the pressures on time-wise as well, to do all that hand-picking.
It is,
By the time you've tested it all, the crop will be dead, right?
That's right. So we had to develop a test that was really rapid. We can also detect disease by actually taking the leaf and plating the leaf onto media to allow the pathogen that's in it to grow out, but that's really a time-intensive process. But we're hoping we can collect leaves in one day, extract the DNA the next and perform the test and then have a result. So we're hoping to have a 2 or 3 day turnaround, which then means industry can have that information and then make a decision on what fungicide they might put on next or if they even need to apply another fungicide in that program.
How important a crop is pyrethrum?
Pyrethrum is a really important crop. So we are actually the global leader in pyrethrum production here on the northwest coast. We grow it to harvest the seed, and the seed has a high concentration of special chemicals called pyrethrins. And pyrethrins are insecticides. And so we extract them here in Ulverston, and then they're formulated into commercial pesticide products. And you might have even seen them at Bunnings. And pyrethrins are a really important type of pesticide because they're natural, they have a broad range of control, they have rapid knockdown of many pests and diseases, but they aren't prolonged in the environment, so we don't see resistance developing like we do to a lot of our synthetic insecticides that are on the market.
Right, as in resistance in the insects?
In the insects, yep. So we can spray the pyrethrin and we don't see the tolerance build up in pests like we do for other. The other benefit of them is they can also be used for organic markets because they are a natural product.
So how important then is is this rapid testing? Is there demand from people who are growing pyrethrum?
Yeah, so pyrethrum has a lot of fungal diseases, and one of the ways that the industry control fungal diseases is with fungicides. The issue we have is that some of the pathogens that infect pyrethrum have actually developed resistance to the fungicides we're using, and we don't have a whole lot of chemistries available. Any way we can make the control more specific to the target pathogen that we need, it means we're not putting sprays on that we don't need to. So, for example, if we have a lot of ray blight in the paddock, we might say, okay, we have a chemistry that controls ray blight, we'll put that on. But if that same paddock had a lot of tan spot, we might say, okay, we can't use that product because we know the pathogen isn't sensitive to it anymore. It's giving industry a tool to be able to understand what's in their paddock rather than just saying, all right, I'm going to put on five fungicide sprays without knowing what's present and how they might be controlled by those five fungicide sprays. So at the moment, industry put on five sprays as part of their spring fungicide program, I think. And what this test might mean is we might get to spray four, be able to do our testing, and then actually work out we don't need number five because the disease levels are low enough that they won't have an impact on yield.
That's Research Fellow Dr. Tamika Pierce from the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture talking to Meg Ferguson about her research into the beautiful flower pyrethrum, ending the Country Hour for today. Don't forget ABC Rural Online, plenty of great stories there, and ABC Rural Facebook page. We'll catch you during lunch hour of the cricket tomorrow.